Maynard Smith. This particular event is one of several organized by LSE's Center for the Philosophy of Natural and Social Science to celebrate the center's 10th anniversary. And in conjunction with these events, the center has also launched an appeal for funding with the aim of securing its long-term future. It's an immense privilege for me to be able to introduce John Maynard Smith to you, for he is just quite simply among the greatest of living biologists. Indeed, I always personally think of him as one of Darwin's representatives on Earth. By contrast, it wasn't always like that. At one time, my only knowledge of John was as the author of one of those old blue and white Pelican books, I'm sure you all know what I mean, whatever age you are, that was on my parents' bookshelves. It was called The Theory of Evolution. It was first published in 1958, and it is still going strong. I even saw it in the Economist bookshop, in Dylan's bookshop this afternoon. So I was, at that point, very ignorant of him. John, however, was manifestly unimpeded by my relative ignorance of his very existence, for he rapidly went on to make some of the most profound contributions to our understanding of evolution. It was he who transformed evolutionary thinking with the systematic application of game theory, which was a tool that he borrowed in part from economics, very suitably for LSE, but he returned it to the social sciences, very nicely honed and Darwinized, and it's now wielded to great effect in the study of our own species. John also took on biology's very big questions: why aging and why death, why sex, and how do living things incorporate information, making possible life's wondrous complexity. Among the many, many recognitions that John has received is the biological equivalent of a Nobel Prize received just last year. It's Sweden's Crawford Prize. And John is very quick to acknowledge his extremely august benefactors. In their latest book, his co-author thanks a very impressive list of academic institutions. Then comes John's list. Quote, JMS owes a similar debt to the University of Sussex and to the Swan Pub at Falmer. In Who's Who, John lists among his recreations talking. I'm reminded of another acknowledgement to a colleague in another of his books. Quote, much of this book is a debate between us in which he is not allowed to get a word in edgeways. And whilst on John's books, may I take this occasion to say how very proud I am of his elegant essay called Shaping Life, which is in our own Darwin at LSE series, Darwinism Today, and also how very grateful I am, John, to your unfailing support for our Darwin at LSE program. Well, it's high time for us to benefit from John's favorite recreation. I'm delighted to ask John Maynard Smith to speak about the future of biology. I think nobody should be there. Yes.
Good. I know you think it's gin, but it's not. My throat isn't very good. It's a long time, actually, since I have been so nervous about giving as a lecture as I am right now. Normally, when I lecture, I have some knowledge of the topic upon which I'm talking. I haven't really any proper qualification for talking about the future of biology. I'm going to be talking mainly about genetics, but I'm not a molecular geneticist. I'm certainly not a genetic engineer. I have virtually no knowledge of medicine. In fact, I have none of the necessary background knowledge to give this lecture. So please don't take too seriously anything that I'm going to say. In any case, you should not have asked a scientist to talk about the future of science. The people who do occasionally write well about the future of science and the future in general are writers of science fiction. A book which probably had a bigger influence on me than anything I've ever read was written in 1933. Was written in 1933 by a man called Olaf Stapleton and called Last and First Men, just as an experiment. Has anybody in the room read it? Oh, good, good. But you're all a bit old. That was an oldish sub-sample. It's a quite extraordinary book. I read it, I think, when I was 15, a year or two after it came out. He predicts, it's a history of the next 100 million years or so, but he deals with an immediate future in more detail. He discusses atomic war. He discusses the collapse of civilization due to an oil crisis. He discusses the building of giant brains, not out of silicon, which he couldn't really guess, so they're made of neurons. But his major thesis is that if human beings are ever to build a stable and happy society, they will first have to change themselves. And the giant brains, as a matter of fact, are built in order to change a human nature. Now, I'm not sure whether I think he was right or not. But, I mean, looking around the world, there are times when you think that if we don't change our nature, we really don't have much of a chance. But let's face it, if we're to have a chance at all, we'll have to do it with the nature we've got. We don't have either the skills or the time to change it, as Stapleton imagined. But this book completely blew my mind when I read it at the age of 15 or so. It made me fascinated in genetics, fascinated in evolution, and I suppose it's as much as anything else responsible for where I am standing today. But I can't resist telling an anecdote about it. I wasn't the only person upon whom this book had that effect. Quite recently, 10 years ago or so now, I was reading a book of short stories by Arthur C. Clarke, which I haven't recovered from science fiction entirely, and he gives a short biography in an introduction. And he describes how he read when he was a boy, Last and First Men, and it made him into the writer of science fiction. Now that's sort of perhaps not surprising. It's a very remarkable book. He tells us that he took it out of the local public library in a little town on the edge of Exmoor called Minehead. So did I. It was the same physical copy of the book. And I find that rather moving. I mean, I don't know where the librarian who put that book on the shelves is today, up there or down there or in limbo, but I think both Clarke and I have a lot to thank him for. But however, it is clearly the future of genetics and the application of genetics that I have to talk about. 100 years ago, beginning of the last century, with the exception of a few far-sighted people, biologists didn't even really think that there were atoms of heredity. Mendel's laws had been forgotten and were just to be rediscovered. We didn't even know there were genes. By halfway through the century, we knew not only that there were genes, how they behaved, we also knew their chemical constitution, and by the end of the century, we had enormous power of moving these genes around, of sequencing them, understanding their role in development, in behavior, and so on. And I'm not going to try and predict, I'm sorry about this, but I just am not competent, I don't think anyone is, I'm not going to try to predict what future discoveries of comparable scope will occur in the next century. If there are any young people here, I don't think if I was young, I'd go for genetics. I think we've had our big breakthroughs in genetics. What would I do? I think I'd be in neurobiology. I don't know. I mean, it's so confusing and muddled right now that they sure as hell need a few breakthroughs, and so that's where I'd go if I was young, I think. Before, some of the things I'm going to say may seem somewhat alarming, so I want just to point to one piece of what I think is good news for the future of our species. There's lots of bad news out there. The one piece of good news, I think, is that it does appear that the exponential increase in human numbers has ceased. It's not that our numbers are no longer increasing, but we've passed the sort of blip in the S-curve. It looks as if human numbers are going to flatten out. And what is also rather encouraging is that the cause of this appears not to have been the Malthusian prediction of starvation and disease and so on, because the change has occurred first in the wealthiest countries and in the wealthiest groups within those countries. And it seems really that the crucial change has been the possibility open to us, and to women in particular, of limiting their fertility, the education and the advantages of doing so. So essentially, I think that this, so I do regard a flattening out of human numbers as a necessary, if not a, not a sufficient condition, but at least it's a necessary condition if we're to solve any of our other problems without total disaster. And at least that bit of news looks good. And I think we owe it to, essentially, to the empowerment of women as far as their own reproduction in the future is concerned. However, back to genetics. I had originally, when I started thinking about this lecture, thought I was going to have to talk about genetically modified food. I'm not going to have time, which is my excuse for not doing it, but actually I find the topic rather boring, so I'm rather relieved that I'm not going to have to. I guess, because of the date and what's happening, in some sense, perhaps I ought to start with the genome project and the fact that very soon now a complete human genome sequence is likely to be published. This has been sold as the blueprint of life. Sorry, I'm bad at that, am I?
No, it's just your... Can you...
That's going to be okay?
Is that better?
Am I audible in the top there? Look, I'm very myopic, but if I become inaudible, shout. Okay, loudly. Okay.
Still not good.
Not very good? There's no way I can shout, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry about the sound. I can't shout because my throat will collapse. It's not in good state.
Close to the microphone.
Yeah, I'll try and be close to the mic. Okay. To be honest, I'm not sitting on the edge of my seat waiting for the publication of the human genome. It's actually going to tell us almost nothing. As an outsider, it seems to me more an unseemly race to see who gets to patent things that shouldn't be patentable in the first place. The human genome by itself, and I emphasize by itself, will not tell you anything very much. It's rather as if you wanted to learn Hungarian and somebody gave you a list of all the Hungarian words, but not any of them defined. No idea what any of them mean. The Human Genome Project will be useful as a kind of map to discover specific things, so that if, as a result of studies of families or populations, a gene is suspected to exist, responsible, let's say, for early onset Alzheimer's or something of that kind, that you mind about, that you would like to find, you know roughly where it is, the existence of the human genome will be a useful tool in pinning it down. So, sure, it was worth having the genome, but the idea that it's going to be interesting when published is balmy. It's going to be deeply boring. So, first of all, what can we actually learn about human beings that is likely to be interesting by genetic means? Well, clearly, if it were the case that all men are created equal, and women as well, then the short answer to that would be nothing. Genetics, as my old teacher, J.B.S. Haldane, used to start his undergraduate lectures by telling us, is the study of the innate differences between fairly similar organisms, in this case between human beings. Genetics tells you why X is different from Y. It's not very good at telling you why there are the things they have in common. Evolutionary theory may help you to understand why they have certain things in common, but the human genome isn't going to help you very much. Now, what kind of genetic differences are interesting interesting in the sense that they might actually be useful to know? Well, there's a widespread class of characteristics which we would all agree, I think, if given a choice, we would not wish a child we bore to have. I have in mind things like cystic fibrosis or Clay-Sachs disease or something of that kind, we would all know that that is not a condition that we would wish a child of ours to have, and if we could prevent it from having it, we would wish to do so. These are conditions caused by single mutant genes. And there are many such conditions. Many of them have been known for a long time. That's the first and simplest category, a category of conditions such that if you have a particular single locus genetic constitution, it may be, if it's a recessive, you have to have it in double dose. If it's a dominant, like Huntington's, you can have it in single dose. You are going to suffer from some very serious and unpleasant condition. And that's straightforward. But it's not the only kind of genetic constitution which we might be interested in. There's actually a much commoner, and in sum total of human unhappiness, probably more important range of conditions, varying from the tolerable and just annoying to the really serious, which are not caused by a single mutant gene being present, but in which, nevertheless, there is some, as yet often not well understood, genetic predisposition. I mean, I have in mind things like dyslexia, to take one which is a great nuisance, but, you know, nothing to kill yourself about. You can live with it. It's just a bore. Early onset Alzheimer's, which is familial, and known to be caused by, in some cases, by, there are several genes believed to be involved in this, or one that I'll talk about a little bit more, schizophrenia. But there are many such conditions which are varying degrees of seriousness, which we would prefer not to suffer from. Now, in none of those cases, certainly not, and I'll talk a little about schizophrenia, it is certainly not the case that if you have a given genetic constitution, you will be a schizophrenic, and if you do not, you won't. The causation is a complex interaction between genetic predisposition and environment, upbringing, the way you've been treated, and there's more than one kind of genetic constitution, or so it seems likely, which can predispose you to schizophrenia. Nevertheless, it's clear evidence that there is a genetic predisposition. It's not just how you were brought up by your parents. That's relevant, but it's not the whole story. For example, how do we know that? If you compare twins, the correlation for the presence of schizophrenia in monovillar twins, that is genetically identical twins, is 0.7. And between fraternal twins, let's say twins which are no more similar than a brother and sister genetically, it's 0.3. And the same story emerges from adoption studies, studies of relatives, and so on. There's no question that there is a genetic predisposition there. So that's the second category of genetic difference, unlike something like Huntington's, and it's not a single gene, and it's not all genetic, but it certainly isn't all environmental either. There's a third category of differences which we may be interested in, but are not actually associated necessarily with traits that we would really want either to have or not to have. For example, athletic ability. To mention one that I conspicuously lack, musical ability. I wasn't quite as bad as Haldane. With Haldane, we had to tell him when they were playing God Save the King so that he could remain seated. Now, I can recognize God Save the King, but I'm pushed. And I don't believe that this is my upbringing. My mother was very keen on music, tried to get me to listen to music and play music and so on. Just got all the wrong genes. But I doubt very much whether it's one gene. I would think it's much more likely to be a quantitative thing. But certainly things like athletic ability or intelligence or a whole series of other traits, we are going to be able, in the coming 20 years or so, to identify many of the genetic differences between somebody who finds mathematics easy, let's say, and somebody who finds it very difficult. And it's unlikely to be a single gene. And of course, ability to do mathematics depends upon your education as well as upon your genetic constitution. But we are going to be able to identify what is now pompously called quantitative trait loci in humans, just as we can identify these other things. So we're going to know these kinds of things. The question is, what good is it going to do? But before I discuss that, I want to digress what may seem to be a digression for a moment. I'm now going back, say, 15 years or so, when I still taught undergraduates. Occasionally I would ask them, in a tutorial, not, do you think it likely that schizophrenia or depression or what you will is genetically caused, but would you be pleased if it turned out that there was an important component of genetic causation? In those days, and I'm going back 15 or 20 years, the general answer was one of great shock that anyone would suggest even that it could be genetically caused, and a feeling that it would be a terrible thing if it turned out to be true. At that time, the evidence one way or the other was very poor. We didn't really know. Today it's a good deal stronger. I think, however, I don't know that I've succeeded in persuading many students. I'm not even sure that it's my business to persuade students of this sort of thing. But to me, at least, it would have to be good news if it turned out to have a strong genetic component. Why? Because these are conditions we would rather be without. There is at least some real chance of curing a condition if it turns out to have an important genetic component. If it's simply that your parents were beastly to you, your chances of doing much about it are zero. And your chances of altering parental behavior on a wide enough scale to reduce the incidence of disease is pretty small either. On the whole, the first point I rather want to make is that if something has a genetic component, it's probably good news. So, wondering where I've got to, sorry. I think a possible reason why people are disturbed about the idea that we might discover that some difference was genetic is a fear that of eugenics, and a fear, a justified fear to some extent, of eugenics. Today, eugenics is a dirty word. There's no two ways about it. I mean, you have to dress it up if you want to put to somebody that there might be a case for eugenics. But it wasn't always so. If you go back to the days I was talking about, when the 1930s, when Last and First Men was written, so far from being unpopular, in the early 30s, and certainly in the 1910 to 1920 sort of period, it was almost the religion of the intellectual middle classes. And it wasn't in any way associated with being politically right-wing or anything of that kind. I mean, the Webbs were in favor of it, George Bernard Shaw was in favor of it, Murray Stopes, whom I would think of as somebody who was a kind of fighter for women's rights, was a rabid eugenist, and even disinherited her son because he married a girl with myopia, which, let's face it, puts me in my place. I mean, eugenic views were really widespread in those days. And it wasn't just, scientists, but geneticists were as involved in this kind of thing as anybody else. We knew very little human genetics, or very little human genetics was known, so you could believe what you liked. I dug up one quotation for you, which I kind of like. This is from a man called Davenport, an American geneticist, who actually was the man who established the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, which most biologists will have heard of. Writing in 1911, he says that immigration would rapidly make the American population darker in pigmentation, smaller in stature, more given to crimes of larceny, kidnapping, assault, murder, rape, and sex immorality. Now, that's good, strong stuff. His evidence for that view is tenuous. But views of that kind were not all that unusual in those days. I think the thing that changed that, the event that changed that more than anything else, was the coming to power in Germany of Hitler and the Nazis, who applied eugenic measures, initially just sterilization of people they didn't like, on an enormous scale. You must understand that such measures had been applied. The sterilization of criminals was accepted as state law in a number of states of the United States, and in fact continued to be practiced in Scandinavia right up to the 1970s. So such measures were not all that unknown, but they were carried out on a scale and a motivation quite abnormal in comparison with anything that had gone before in Nazi Germany, and ultimately, of course, finished in the gas chambers. So I think it was in realization of the sins that can be committed in the name of eugenics that people who previously had been at least interested or vaguely sympathetic with the notion became deeply hostile to it. I'm going to be talking about measures which may, in a sense, be seen as eugenic. So I want to make it quite clear that I think there are two principles that we should aim to follow in any genetic interference in our own species that we may make. The first is the decision in any particular case what to do should not be a decision for government, should not be a decision for the doctor or doctors, for a scientist or scientists. It should be a decision, since one's normally taking decisions about maybe an as yet unborn child, should be a decision for the parents of that child, and primarily, since it's still true that the mother takes the primary responsibility for raising a child, for the mother of that child. So decisions have to be individual. They should not be government or state or profession. The other is that before we do take eugenic measures of any kind, we should be clear what our objectives are, and those objectives should be the avoidance of conditions which we are absolutely clear in our minds we want to avoid. And I would hope that people would not regard myopia as so serious as to be grounds for an early termination, or I wouldn't be with you this evening. Okay, so given that decisions of what to do should be ultimately in the parents' control and not in the control of any lawgiver, what can be done? Essentially, there are three kinds of levels at which we might try to use genetic knowledge. Crudely, they are, just to give you a sort of list of them, there's gene therapy, there is diagnosis of genetic conditions of embryos, together with selection of embryos, and there is genetic transformation. Those are three quite different procedures, and it's important to be clear what they are. In gene therapy, there is no question of trying to alter anybody's genetic constitution. The notion is that you find out what gene it is they're missing, let us say the cystic fibrosis gene, and you try to deliver copies of that gene to the place in their body while they're developing, growing, that it is needed, and try to switch it on in that place so that the genetic deficiency that they suffer from is, in a sense, cured, though the gene is not altered. My impression of such therapy is that it has not really fulfilled its promise, if it ever had it. It's not easy to get the genes into the right place. It's easy enough to make large numbers of the genes, actually. That's not the problem. The problem is to get them where you want them and to switch them on there and not somewhere else. And although, I did tell you at the beginning that I'm not medically qualified, I could just be wrong about that. But my general impression, looking at it the outside, that this is not actually a particularly promising line of approach. A line of approach which is already practical in some single gene conditions, where one knows specifically the gene that one wants to avoid, and will become possible certainly in the second category that I discussed, conditions like schizophrenia and depression and so on, where it's not one gene you'd like to alter but several, is to identify the genetic constitution of a future child and prevent its birth. Now, until relatively recently, the method that they adopted was amniocentesis, that is to say, after the embryo had been implanted and attached to the placenta in the mother's womb, placental cells from the amnion, those belong to the embryo and not to the mother, are taken, genetically diagnosed, and if the child has a condition that the parents consider sufficiently serious, an abortion is performed. That is, I think it's fair to say, no longer really a necessary procedure. There is a better way of doing it, which I hope increasingly will be adopted. At least it seems to me better, it may not to you. This is to collect embryos when they're just a small ball of cells, perhaps 16 to 64 cell stage sort of situation, before they're implanted in the mother's womb. Take one cell from such a ball of cells, it's all you need nowadays for genetic diagnosis. And if it is carrying the gene or genetic constitution that you do not want, to discard that embryo. Now, if you're at all sensitive, you'll notice that I was conscious of it when I used it, the word discard that embryo and not kill it. But of course they mean the same, in effect. I fully understand anyone who has a deep moral objection to killing any embryo. It's certainly not a decision I would want to have to take. But I do want to emphasize that it is not a scientific issue. It's a decision to be made, in my view, by parents, essentially, not by doctors or scientists or governments, as to whether that is the right action or not. But thinking about it, I'm fairly clear that had it been possible, when we were having our children, to identify at the sort of 16-cell stage whether an embryo was carrying some specific condition or not, and if there had been good grounds for fearing, for family reasons or other genetic tests, which can increasingly be made, that such a condition might be present, then I think I would have wanted to do it and to discard the embryo if it was carrying that. You can always collect a dozen embryos and keep the one that's all right. But I do want to emphasize, I don't regard this as something that is free of quite hard moral problems that need thinking about. And it's certainly not up to me to tell you what you ought or ought not to do. As I say, I think that method is already possible and will become increasingly possible for both single gene conditions and for conditions in which there's a genetic component in causation, which is relatively simple, not hundreds of genes, but just a few genes. The third possible, in principle possible method, is that of genetic transformation. In effect, you try to identify the gene that you wish to change, if it be wrong, and you actually transform it. Now, in a nutshell, that is what is being done in the origin of genetically modified crops, well, or animals. It's not at the moment a technically practical proposition as far as human beings are concerned, and as far as I can see, is not likely to become so, at least not in the at all foreseeable future, but what will be possible in 50 years' time, one would be mad to predict, I think. The point being that it's no good changing one gene, you've got to change lots of them. You've got to change them in a very specific and particular way in producing a new breed of animal or plant. You're not actually changing a gene, you're introducing a new gene into the genome. And you don't mind if you have lots of failures so long as you bring it off once. But that's not really quite the kind of thing that you would want to do or feel justified in doing in the human context. So I don't at the moment see genetic transformation as being a useful or likely to be useful technique in human genetics. I must say just a word about cloning, because cloning is so much in the news nowadays. Of course, some of us have been cloning for years, I'm a keen gardener. I take lots of cuttings. You know, I'm cloning. I'm cloning a plant, not a human being. And you can't grow another human being from a cutting. Or so it seems. It's also true, of course, as everyone realizes, that there are clones out there already. A pair of identical twins are two members of a clone. It's not a very big clone, but it's a clone. What is now technically possible and has been achieved in animals, but not in humans, as far as I know, has been to take an egg, remove from it its nucleus, and replace that nucleus by a nucleus from an adult organism, for one cell of that adult organism, put it back into the mother, hope that it will implant, hope that it will come to term, hope that it will produce you a viable organism. This also is, at the moment, a quite impractical technique for human reproduction, essentially because of the success rate. I mean, the success rate of, you know, of the eggs you re-implant, the proportion that come through to live birth is probably less than 1 in 100. Now, and you get, you're lumbered with a large number of abnormalities and diseased organisms and so on. Now, that clearly is not something which we are prepared to tolerate in reproducing our own species, or at least I hope it isn't. But techniques advance. I mean, it may not be true in even in 20 years' time that that kind of mortality is still with us. So the problem comes, okay, so why would you want to do it? I have to say I can't think of any good reasons for wanting to do it in order to produce a new human being. I mean, some of you will have read The Boys from Brazil, which is a kind of good novel. This is the cloning of Hitler, if you haven't actually read it. And it's a good story, no question. But I can't see a lot of justification for any human being thinking another copy of me is what the world needs. I really can't. If you read what is being proposed by the people who are actually working on cloning with the possibility that it might be applied in human biology, what they are proposing is not the production of new human beings, like ones that are already existing. They're proposing cloning for therapeutic purposes. That is to say, I, fearing that I may get burnt in an accident or something, arrange for a clone of myself to be differentiated as skin cells all ready to slap on when I have this accident. Or, if not, that's rather an easy one to produce some skin cells. It's much harder to produce a new heart and keep it in the fridge until I need it. I must say I'm a little puzzled as to the practicality of this particular proceeding. But it is for that reason that cloning is being proposed. So far, mainly, except when I got on to cloning, I have been talking about what I call negative eugenics, of taking measures to prevent the birth of children with particularly serious and distressing conditions. What about positive eugenics? What about trying to produce so-called, the phrase is, designer babies? But I must say, when I came across the phrase, I had to go and ask somebody what was a designer baby, because I've never worn a designer shirt or a designer trainers or something in my life. I didn't know what the phrase meant, but it was explained to me. They took me away in the corner and told me what designer meant. Let me give you some free, unsolicited advice. If you want to have a child who is extraordinarily athletic or extraordinarily clever or extraordinarily musical, I can offer you two pieces of advice you might follow. One would be provided with an upbringing which will encourage whatever particular quality it is that you want. My own total failure to remember or recognize tunes shows that you cannot guarantee that this measure will succeed. So the second measure, which my mother failed to choose, t- take, but would have been maybe effective if she had, is just choose your sexual partner more carefully. My father couldn't sing in tune either. If you want to produce children of a given kind, at the moment the best things you can do is to give it the right kind of upbringing and choose your partners carefully. I don't say that's what you have to do, but if what you want is a child of a particular kind, that's what you have to do. I don't see a lot of future right now for the production of designer babies, but I do want to digress for a moment, having talked about the sort of designer babies, cloning and so on. I wouldn't encourage anybody to engage in such an activity, either as a doctor or as an individual wishing to be cloned or to have a child of a particular kind. Do we want to pass laws making it illegal? I think that's much harder, because those laws seem to me to be extraordinarily hard to enforce. It's easy enough to pass a law saying thou shalt not do something, but if its only effect is to ensure that in some island not under the direct control of your own government, a thriving medical profession is making its millions doing it for people rich enough to go there and have it done, it doesn't seem to me that you've done much by passing the law. So I think one has to think rather carefully about whether passing laws against things in this field is a very good idea. One example of positive eugenics, which I do want to discuss some, a little bit more, is the question of producing human beings, or indeed treating existing human beings, so that they live for very much longer, live for 200 years instead of 100 years. For me, it's a slight relief talking about this, because it's actually a topic about which I know something, unlike everything else I've been talking about. I worked on aging a lot back in the 50s and 60s, and I've watched the subject ever since, and one can say with some confidence at any moment there will be a group of people out there with a theory, well, several different theories, different individuals in the group having different theories about the cause of aging. I got a cause, and usually I got a cure for it. When I was young, it used to be, oh, cross-linking of collagen in your connective tissue, autoimmune disease, somatic mutation, were the three commonest, most popular theories when I was working in the field of aging. Nowadays, the latest fashion has been something called telomeres. The idea is that when a chromosome replicates, it has a problem, and please don't push me in the questions afterwards about what the problem is, because I'm not very clear. It has a problem about replicating the end, the telomere, which is the end bit. And the consequence is that every time a chromosome replicates, the telomere just gets shorter and shorter. And the theory is that when the telomere sort of disappeared altogether, the chromosome can no longer divide, the cell can't divide, and you're dead. So all you need to do is to prevent telomere shortening. I got a cure, you'll live forever. Well, I hope that a moment's thought will tell you that that has to be nonsense. I mean, first of all, is it going to stop your teeth falling out? Well, of course it isn't going to stop your teeth falling out. What about your germline? It's clear that there can't be telomere shortening going on there, or your children will be born old. Right? So it's not only a question, is there a simple way of preventing telomere shortening during cell division? There clearly is. It's working in your germline. Then all you need to do is to be an evolutionary biologist. If a simple change transferred to your somatic cells would make you live a lot longer, and live healthily a lot longer, then natural selection would have done it millions of years ago. If there was a simple cure for aging, we'd all live a lot longer because natural selection would favor it. Any individual who lived twice as long would, on average, have twice as many kids. Unless, of course, they were so decrepit they had to be carried around all the time. When I say lived longer, I mean lived healthily longer. A moment's thought about evolutionary biology will tell you there is not a single simple cure for aging, which does not have unpleasant side consequences. Not the digression, but why not digress? A graduate student of mine, under some stimulus from me, once demonstrated that if you want to make a female fruit fly live longer, you can do so by giving her 5,000 rads of x-rays. Not a treatment that you would expect to be terribly good for an animal, but what it does is to kill all the dividing cells in her body. The only dividing cells in her body happen to be in her ovary. She doesn't bother with the rest of her cells, she lives with what she's got. And anything you do to a female fruit fly to stop her laying eggs makes her live longer. So it's a cure for aging in fruit flies, but it's not universal because it certainly wouldn't work on you and me, and it carries with it a price. So I don't in fact expect to see a cure, genetic or whatever, for aging. But of course there are things you can do to make life for older people better, to make them stay healthy longer. There are many things like hip replacements, operations for cataract and so on, which do make life better in old people, and I have personal reasons for being in favour of such interventions. So certainly there are things we can do for old people, and there will be more. But the idea that we will find a cause for ageing is rubbish, I believe. Well, I so far talked about possible advantages of genetic engineering methods applied to human beings with provisos. But what about the dangers? I'm frankly not worried that cloning is going to be used to produce a race of Hitlers or something. That isn't close to my concerns. I want to go back to science fiction for a moment. Another author, I read everything he ever wrote, I think, when I was young, was H.G. Wells. I think the most disturbing picture of the future in science fiction known to me is in The Time Machine. Our hero goes into the future and he finds a group of people, very beautiful, apparently happy, dancing, playing games all day, a bit feckless, not very serious, not doing any work, not concerned about the deep matters of philosophy and religion and so on, but having on the whole a fairly good time, except he notices they're a bit scared in the evening when the lights go out. Then he notices in the morning sometimes one or two of them aren't there anymore. Then later, through other adventures, he discovers that living underground, there is a second race of human beings, the Morlocks. The guys on the surface are called Eloi, if I remember rightly. The guys underneath are running machinery. They're efficient, hard-working, fierce, cruel. And among other things, they're farming the Eloi because they're good to eat. And they come up at night and take one or two when they would need one. It's a pretty horrid picture, but Wells makes it clear that this is his image of the future of the class system in the society he lives in. If the upper classes are going to do nothing useful, then natural selection won't preserve their competence and ability to work and to cope, and they'll finish up like the Eloi, beautiful but feckless, whereas the workers who do have to work for their living and so on will finish up like the Morlocks. He finishes up, in other words, describing a class system based on a genetic difference between the classes. Now, I don't say we face that necessarily. I certainly hope we do not. But what we do face is a world in which it may become simply too expensive for any society to provide the best possible medical treatment to everybody. And we may see a world in which the class division is based not so much on what a nice house you live in or how much you have to eat, but on your access to the best in the way of medical services. When I wrote the notes for this lecture, the lecture you can tell isn't exactly written, a week ago, the first example I wrote down was the fact that the most effective drugs for the treatment of HIV are so expensive that they are simply not available to people in Africa where HIV is a extremely serious and widespread disease. A mild bit of good news, I'm delighted to hear that the companies that have been maintaining that high price have, during the last week, announced they have cut the price by a factor of nearly 10, I think, down to the actual cost of production, and that has to be good news. But it is an example of the fact that a health treatment urgently needed may be too expensive for the people who urgently need it to buy. That by itself would be bad enough. I mean, supposing I'm wrong about aging, for example. If we lived in a world in which, if you were rich, you lived for 200 years, but if you were poor or came from a poor country, you'd be lucky to make 80, I don't think such a society would be a very good one to live in. I mean, that fact would carry with it so much else in the way of special police states to maintain the class division that it's not a happy vision. If part of the genetic application was not merely in curing individuals, but altering the genetic constitution of populations, Wells's dream is perhaps not quite so impossible as you might have imagined. It's not a dream that any of us can welcome, but I do think it means that very serious thought has to be given to the control of future medical services, the access of people to those medical services. I will reveal my own political opinion if I say that I don't find it a very happy situation where the control of the drugs and so on are going to be in the hands, not even of governments, but of big companies, who will always tell you that their moral duty is to serve their shareholders. But of course, helping their shareholders is not precisely helping people. So I don't know the answer to any of these questions, but I do think that they're questions that my grandchildren are going to have to worry about, even if I'm too old to have to worry. And I now come to a blank piece of paper, which is slightly a relief. It means I've come to the end of my notes, and I haven't any idea what else I'm going to say. You'll notice what I have not talked about seriously is what future discoveries are likely to be made, except that I think I did hint at the beginning that if I were 25 instead of 80, I think it would be neurobiology rather than genetics that I would be going into. Except you may say, look, you're such an incompetent experimentalist, the idea that you could ever become a neurobiologist is bizarre. And that, of course, is actually true. But I have a suspicion that some study of computers, artificial intelligence, and so on might possibly play some useful role in that field. And that, I think, I probably could do. But it does bring me to just the last thing I want to just say a word about before I stop and let you get it back at me. You're going to have half an hour to ask me questions. The shorter I can make that period, the better from my point of view. Well, I don't know the answers, you understand. My friend Ersath Murray and I recently wrote a book called The Origins of Life, which, if you haven't bought it, don't read it, that doesn't help me at all. Buy it, that's my royalties. We wrote a book called The Origins of Life, in which we picture evolution as involving a series of what we call major transitions in the way in which information is stored and transmitted between generations. The origin of the genetic code, the origin of chromosomes, the origin of cells, the origin of multicellular organisms, of animal communities, of sex, and finally of language. And we argue that each of these major transitions was a necessary stage in making possible the further evolution of complex life. In the last paragraph, we point out that we are now living through yet another of these major transitions, and we cop out from discussing it. And that, of course, is the transition involved by the invention of computers. Today, for the first time in the whole of evolution, the history of the Earth, there exist two independent, different, separate methods of storing and transmitting information. The genetic method, dependent upon DNA, RNA, proteins, so on, and the method, the electronic method, dependent at the moment upon silicon, but it may well be that the actual units used for storing and transmitting information in computers will become more and more biological, actually, as the years go by. I don't know. But at least we have computers and we have human beings living side by side in a strange symbiosis. It's a totally novel situation. Its consequences will be as dramatic, I'm sure, as the other major transitions that Ersch and I discuss. What they will be, I don't know. I mean, the worst scenario from our point of view is that these computers may simply replace us. They may do very well without us. At the moment, you can say, well, I can pull the plug, switch them off. Well, I'm not so sure you can switch them off all that easily. I mean, if you do, you're going to bring industry to a stuttering halt. Well, maybe that's a price you're willing to pay. We're already very dependent upon these species of machinery. We shall undoubtedly become more dependent upon them. Maybe they will manage to escape being dependent upon us. I don't think it's so obviously wrong that you can just rule it out. A more likely possibility is that we will form some kind of increasingly complex symbiosis with these organisms. And I say organisms because they have many of the properties of organisms. The future of that symbiosis, I simply do not know. I shall not participate in it. I aim to be the last human being, not on email, not owning a mobile telephone, not surfing the internet. I'm a real Luddite in this business, but I realize that that's a pose I can afford because I'm 80 years old. I couldn't afford to do it if I was young. But the next major transition through which life is going to, is at the moment living, is the revolution introduced by the existence of computers. And you really ought to be having one of these futures lectures telling you what it's going to be like, because I don't think I can. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. John's now willing to answer questions that you'll throw at him. We've got two roving mics. For the people upstairs, I'm afraid we haven't got a mic, but if you stand up and speak up, we really can hear you, and I'll repeat the question if people haven't heard. Yes.
What's linked today with the next speech?
Sorry, it was actually somebody behind you. I'll ask you next. I'm sorry.
Okay. I had a question about, you had two principles you would like followed in the context of selection, it was. And the first one I have my doubts about, which was that the selection should be done by individuals and in particular parents. Mm-hmm. I don't doubt so much that that's a good idea, but it seems to me that it's likely to be insufficient. And the particular example that comes to mind is the sexual selection going on in China in using abortion. When the individual choices have collective consequences, it does seem likely that society has some justification in intervening.
Yeah. The sex ratio am I audible here? Yeah, the sex ratio, if people are allowed to choose the sex of their children, is a really rather puzzling one as to how to deal with it. I'm a game theorist. I'm inclined to think that if everybody else is having little girls, people will want to have little boys. And if everybody else is having little boys, they'll want to have little girls. If they have any sense, that is the decision that they will take. You don't want to be the member of the rarer sex. You really don't. Sorry, you do want to be a member of the rarer sex. You do not want to be a member of the commoner sex. Finding a partner is real tough. But that's a partly joking answer to your question. It's perhaps not an entirely serious one. I do think that it is the sex ratio problem where individual choice might be more serious than most of the other contexts in which I discussed it, which I discussed. So I think your point's well made. and I think people will think about it.
Sorry, you know.
Sorry about jumping the queue there. I'd like to connect today with the forthcoming event here on Thursday, which is about future social sciences, which I thought you may go into. I mean, it strikes me one of the biggest crucial thing with future biology is how it's going to deal with explaining and replacing social science, current social science explanations of socialization. Could you comment on that?
Did people hear that? No. The question is, what about the social sciences, and how far is biology going to take over the explanation of society from sociologists? And this is an area in which I'm a real head sitter and don't know. On the one hand, I mean, looking at the biologists I know, they don't seem to me to be the kind of people who are really very good at explaining society, but I feel that even more strongly when I talk to sociologists. So I'm we're faced with a problem here, and I dare say I don't get into dinner now, by the way, because this is a sociological institution, so I'm in trouble. It has to be true that the human ability to, so to speak, live in society is a consequence of our genetic constitution and our evolution. I mean, it's clear that we can do it and fruit flies can't, so the difference between us is essentially a genetic one. It's also, I think, true that the primary difference of a genetic kind that makes a difference is the fact that we can talk and no other animals can. We can use a symbolic communication system to talk to one another. The question that is really hard to answer is how far details of our society depend upon particular details of our nature, our biological nature, that have to be taken into account. I think the best hope is to see people trained in sociology and psychology actually working with biologists on these questions. But there's rather few signs of that, I'm afraid. It seems to me that we still live in isolated academic and intellectual communities without much exchange of ideas, so that I don't see much prospect of a real sociology emerging. However, there is one aspect of it which has fascinated me, and that is the astonishing ease with which human beings can be indoctrinated by myth and ritual and symbol. You know, our passion for wearing silly hats, singing silly songs, marching around wearing stupid clothes, and shouting slogans, and identifying ourselves as members of this, that, or the other race or community or sect or whatever it may be, seems to me to be deeply damaging to our future and to require some sort of biological explanation. Why should we be so easily swayed by myth and ritual, given that I believe we would be a lot better off if we weren't? I'm not sure I know the answer, but it's a question to which I would like to know the answer.
One up there, and then
people
next
to it. Critics of sociology, political psychology, and human behavior. In doing so, do you think these critics are underestimating the threat posed by the corporate police?
Sorry, the corporate?
Yes.
The question is that the critics of sociobiology have criticized the suggestion that genes play a role in human behavior. And the question really is what is the corporate, what's the impact on this of likely to be of the corporate patenting of genes? Well, let me say first of all that I think the corporate patenting of genes has increased and ought to be diminished. I mean, the excuse for corporate patenting of information is, oh well, if you don't let us patent it, we won't bother to find it out. We've got to make profits out of our discoveries, so it's got to be patentable. I have very little sympathy with that argument. I think that genetic information and the uses of genetic information should be as free as possible. And the arguments in favor of patenting, in most contexts, appear to me to be feeble in the extreme. Does this impact upon the sort of sociobiological arguments? I'm not sure that it does. I mean, the extent to which human behavior is, so to speak, totally culturally determined and free to be whatever culture makes it, as opposed to the view that human behavior is under fairly severe genetic constraints, appears to me to be a separate argument, a separate debate.
Lewis Walcott.
Two quick points. I wanted to friend the pharmaceutical industry. You said, you know, they're only in it for the profit, and why not? I need to be persuaded that they really do us harm. I would argue in the field of mental illness, no pharmaceutical companies, no antidepressants, no way of treating schizophrenia. Now, I understand that there's a problem of rationing. I think it's the only ethical issue in relation to biology is rationing, but there is another ethical. So first of all, I want to defend the drug companies. I think they've done a marvelous job in relation to many, many issues. The second thing I want to raise with you is an ethical issue. Is an ethical issue. Mm-hmm. And that is about parents' rights. And it's a question you, very interestingly, and I understand very clearly, that you feel that parents should have the rights as to how the genetics of their children. But let me put to you the question the other way. Do you think that everybody has the right to have a child, even when they know that that child will be very severely genetically disadvantaged? You see, we live in a curious society. Mm-hmm. If you want assisted reproduction, you have effectively to pass an O level in good parenthood. Otherwise, you don't get it. However, if you're a drug addict, a child abuser, you have AIDS, that you're going to have a child with cystic fibrosis, nobody will say a word about your right to have a child. Where do you stand, John?
There's a difference between having a right to do it and passing a law putting you in prison if you do it. I would think somebody who knew that if they had a child, it would have a high risk of a particular genetic condition and went right ahead and did it with acting wrongly. That's an ethical judgment. I'm not so persuaded that I want to see laws passed preventing them from doing so. I'm against laws unless you absolutely must pass them, I think, is part of what I'm saying. I don't think such laws would be easy to police. You say they'll just go. You know, you've only got to go up the, well, it's not quite so bad now, but I was going to say you've only got to go up the escalator in any London main railway station to see what girls in Ireland did because there was a law against abortion. A number of advertisements for, you know, where you can do it. If we start passing laws saying what parents may do, they'll go and do it somewhere else. That may be a cop-out, but I agree with you entirely that I do not think it is a right or moral thing to do to have a child, regardless of what its likely genetic suffering would be.
John Simon. That was less a question, more a point. On the drug companies and the good things they've done. Thank you.
Well, I'll take your word for it, but. I'm not entirely persuaded they did it because they were doing me a favor. They did it because they thought they were going to make a lot of money. And they did make a lot of money. I think the amount of money they should be allowed to make should be very seriously constrained. That's all.
Yes, John.
John Simon.
Oh, John, yes.
Hello.
Sorry.
I think one of the things that's coming out of what you've been saying, and about all the talk about this is not so much genetic determination or biological determination, but determinability to some extent. That is to say, certain things that are as a result of your genetic makeup will be known about what will happen to you in your future life. Mm-hmm. Now, this actually takes out of life a certain degree of randomness. It has effects all over the place in society, doesn't it? It has effects on insurance. It has effects on meritocracy. I mean, the whole idea of certain aspects of our life is that, you know, you struggle and you do your best, and goodness, you're lucky, and you deserve to be successful because we couldn't work it out. Whereas if you know from infancy that you were born with a superior set of genetics, even though they couldn't have been changed, that's pushing you far ahead in the race. And correspondingly, if you're born with a potential defect, it's pushing you back a long way in the race, and it changes all sorts of things in society in ways that we ought to be taking account of.
Yes, I'm not going to be able to answer any of the questions that are being asked, I can see that, but there are just two comments I'd make in reply. First of all, one of the reasons I'm against human cloning, even if it were possible, or artificial insemination by particular donors. Imagine that you personally, as a small boy, discovered that you were a clone of Francis Crick. Now, Francis is one of my favorite men. If I had to be a clone of somebody, I'd love it. But so long as nobody knew, neither my parents nor me, it wouldn't matter. But if it was a known fact, think of one's parents. Well, you little beast, when are you going to discover something? You know, I mean, the pressure on you to perform if you were known to have a particular genetic constitution would be crippling. The other thing is, a thing that did worry me a lot, but I'm inclined to think that it's coming out right, is that if you say, for example, dyslexia is an example I took. There's nothing ignoble about being dyslexic, and there's nothing crippling about it. It's just a bit of a nuisance. And you have the good luck of getting somebody to write your exam scripts for you, which seems to be rather jolly. But if you pick out something, some trait, and say, you know, we are going to make it possible to avoid having a child with that particular condition, then aren't you making that trait somehow or other ignoble, so that if people who have it are going to feel suffering? My impression is that it's not working out that way, and that in fact, the fact that it is known that something has a genetic constitution is making people say, okay, so it's sort of natural that should happen. I'm not going to blame the person for it, we're not going to think worse of them for it, it's just part of human variability. So it's not clear to me that identifying that something is genetically caused is necessarily going to make people with that condition less well off. They might even benefit a bit. I think it's hard to know.
I'm very wary about social commentators who kind of use arguments about big companies or the kind of dystopia of genetic card systems. Because although very often the arguments are presented in kind of quite radical terms, the end conclusion, it seems to always be we need to rein back some of this medical and technical innovation, because if it's not checked in some way, then there'll be some terrible outcome. I remember, just to illustrate that, a few years ago, there was a huge debate in the press about a little girl who had severe immune deficiencies of some kind of horrible condition. And she was being given genetic therapy, pioneering genetic therapy in America. And all the commentary around that case was saying, isn't it immoral that in a world where half the population is starving, that so much resources has been given to this little girl? And for me, the answer should be a resounding yes. Of course that medical technology should be developed, even if it is only
Well, I mean, I sympathize with what you're saying, but look, I don't think that I was recommending that we do not do research or even apply what are essentially eugenic measures of selecting embryos to which ones we're going to allow to come through and which we're not. I certainly wasn't arguing that we shouldn't do the research to enable us to identify differences that we might wish to select on, merely because it could be ill-used. I mean, I think we should go ahead and do it. So I'm not trying to rein back the applications, but I nevertheless think it would be desirable to have some kind of idea of what the dangers are. And they do seem to me to be very real. I mean, I don't feel happy with saying, oh, well, it's all right, we can trust the drug companies. I don't.
Jerome Byrne. Sorry, first Jerome, yes. I'll ask you soon.
Well, to take your second point first, there is a great deal... Sorry, the second point is the fact that the only bits that they're actually going to sequence in detail and publish of the human genome are the coding regions and the regulatory regions upstream of them. And that there's a great deal, in fact, the majority of the human genome, a very substantial majority, is thought not to be saying anything sensible. It's sort of garbage DNA, to use the phrase in current use. And the question is, how sure are we that it really is garbage? Well, one's never sure of anything of that kind, but it sure as hell looks like garbage. I mean, that's not an answer to your question, but I'm not all that worried by the fact that a great deal of it is garbage. After all, nobody's intending to get rid of it. You see what I mean? Well, obviously one has to ask those questions, and if there's any sign of some of the DNA that you didn't know performing useful function actually performing something useful, then we should know about it. But a great deal of it is repetitive, you know, sort of tens of thousands of copies of some short, untranslated regions sprinkled around the genome, different in different individuals. I find it hard to believe that it has much sense. But there may be bits of nuggets of sense in there we don't know about. I'm not fussed about that terribly at the moment. The other question, remind me.
Patenting genes versus patenting the application of them.
Yeah, no, clearly, if you have a not only sequence of gene, but you have pioneered some application of that information, then to patent that application is not different from any other patent. And I can quite understand why lawyers see it as an entirely proper thing to do. So that's the law and we should live with it. I think that the freedom of patenting, but even biological applications, that kind should be severely looked at and should be limited rather than extended. But my major objection is simply to patenting the sequence without any application of it at all. And when I made my crack about the fact that the human genome seemed to be a competition to be the first to patent something that shouldn't be patentable, it's just a sequence that I object to patenting. But I have less sympathy for the freedom to patent applications even than I think most people in this room would have.
Brief questions, because several people want to get in. I promised you first.
I'll be brief. You suggested that one of the new problems that genetic developments might give rise to is lack of access to poor people or affluent. However, even today, life expectancy in some countries is literally twice what it is in others. In this light, would you not agree that while this is a problem, it's hardly going to be particularly a new problem? It's already a problem we face today.
Could you repeat the first part? I didn't get the point.
Sorry. You suggested that one of the problems with new developments in genetics would be unequal access and that poor people would not get so much access as rich ones. Mm. In fact, this is already equally as much a problem today as we
They're already
vast. No, sure, there's lots of inequalities in the world. Why bother about more? Let me put it to you. So I think there is a difference of scale here, if not of kind. Let's take the example I gave, though I think it's an unlikely one, of longevity. If it were possible for rich people to buy 200 years of life and poor people not to, I do not think that a society which permitted that would be a good society to live in. Because you would have to have so many armed men defending the rich against the poor, apart from anything else. No bloody voting, that's for sure. You pay big prices for inequality. And, okay, I don't like the existing inequalities. But if you create more and deeper ones of a biological nature, you're in real trouble.
The second person in the front here. No, the person next to you, I'm afraid. I promised first. Yes. Could you speak up, please?
It does seem that human beings are extremely prone to latch on to the nearest ideology which happens to be about. And I share your irritation with it. But I'd like to suggest that there's a very, very good reason for this. Because the one thing that all ideologies share in common is the fact that they offer social cohesion, a place to belong to, an effective way of people to belong to each other. And for that very reason, they do have a lot of survival value.
I think actually it's not really a question. You're making a point which I think I really deeply agree with, that the kind of reason why we are so easily moved by rituals, myths, customs of one kind or another, is that our survival may depend upon our belonging to a group which we will feel loyalty to, but will also feel loyalty to us. In other words, it's because belonging to a group actually helps you that you may find it so tempting to identify the symbols of being in that group. Is that a fair misrepresentation or representation? Yeah.
Could you speak loudly and briefly, please?
Do you think it should be illegal for companies or governments to request individuals to provide them with their own genetic code? I'm thinking of insurance companies that give lower rates to people who are
No, the real question about whether it should be illegal for either governments or insurance companies and so on to be able to demand information of an individual of their genetic constitution. In general, I think the answer is yes. I think it should be. I mean, let's face it, it's the end of the insurance industry if one's genetic constitution were, first of all, free public access and, secondly, really did predict your longevity. Insurance, if you think about it, is a curious arrangement whereby insurance companies collect money from long-lived people and give it to short-lived people and charge both parties for doing so. Now, that's all right. I mean, they're performing a useful function. But clearly, if we knew how long people were going to live, it no longer would be a possible industry. I mean, it would simply collapse as an economic proposition. So I think that I'm not a lawyer, I haven't gone into this in detail, but I do think the protection of the privacy of genetic information is one of the things that has to be looked at very carefully.
Quickly, if possible, please.
As a sociologist, I want to... I am put forward, just a few points which might, I hope, interest you. That's the kind of case for sociology being brought to the party, I think.
Yeah.
I thought there was a weakness in what you were saying about an ethical point that arose about eugenics. I like that eugenics is being discussed in the way it is, but it seemed to boil down, and as you were thinking of it, that all kind of possibilities should be pursued, but the vital decisions should be left, ethical decisions should be left to parents, and that then somehow this magic oil would be poured, and you wouldn't need to worry too much about what has been done. Wouldn't you accept that certainly parents should have rights of the kind you were proposing, but what about society somehow coming into it to play a part in determining what research is worth doing? That's before you get to the point where you hand over the magic chalice to the parent. Shouldn't society be there in the picture? And wouldn't you be interested if there were ways in which people could be consulted using some of the skills which you have sociology and you were disparaging, but rightly, in order to find out what people in general might think about the kind of research which you were talking about?
Could you repeat briefly?
And help to have a social input to the question before you actually ask the question, before you get to the parents.
Well, I mean, I can only summarise your question. I've been asked to summarise your question because I think it can't be heard everywhere. It really, the question is whether society and non-scientific individuals ought not to have some kind of control or input over not merely the applications of research, but actually what kind of research is being done. Well, insofar as they can, they do. I mean, that's to say, insofar as research is applied research aimed at solving particular practical problems, it is by and large financed not by the individual scientists doing it, but by industry or by government. So that is very much controlled. What you can't control, and really it is important to understand this, what you cannot control is fundamental scientific research. I am not in favour of governments being able to pass a law saying scientists may not attempt to answer the following question for fear that they might find the answer. I mean, it seems that, for one thing, you don't know what the answer is going to be. You don't even know what question you're going to answer when you do scientific research. I mean, people talk about scientific research as if you said, I'm going to discover X today, and you went out and discovered it. It's just not like that. You're sloshing around in a mystery, puzzled by some odd fact, and you come up with a solution, if you're lucky, which may have all sorts of implications that you could not possibly have foreseen. I'm not in favour of government regulation of that. I don't think it would be a good idea if the government had been able to say to poor old Charles Darwin on the Beagle, don't look at those finches, you might discover something. I mean, it's balmy.
Very quick, please, keep it brief.
One of the greatest painters of all time, Joseph Mallord Turner, supposed to have dyslexia, but he wanted to be an architect and even sometimes musician. There are many musicians and painters that perhaps it was better that they were biologists. Do you think that the wrong decision is part of biology or environment? The wrong decision about your abilities is a positive thing also in society?
Well,
could you say briefly?
I'm not sure that I understand the question. I'm sorry if I'm being stupid. Could you just try to put it again?
What I mean, Joseph Mallord Turner, not only he had dyslexia, but he wanted to be an architect. But it's good that he is a painter because he's one of the greatest.
Yeah.
And sometimes the wrong decisions is part of the game. Is that a positive thing that you find? Or is it biological? When somebody decides wrongly what to do in life?
Well, the question is there a sort of biological factor causing you to sometimes take the wrong decision in your individual life? you're talented to become a painter, but you finish up being a stockbroker or vice versa. I don't know. I know that my family were determined I should become a stockbroker, and I can remember the moment when I told them that whatever else I was going to do with my life, it wasn't that. I mean, I think I knew better than they did what I wanted to spend my life doing. I think if you give people opportunity and you give them an image of the kind of things they might possibly do, I think most people know what they're going to enjoy doing. And most people know what they're going to be good at. And after all, Turner did finish up as a painter. And good thing too, you know.
There are many people still with their hands up, but I apologize to them, but we really should let John have something to drink and something to eat at this point. And I'm sure we'd all like to thank him for a really splendid contribution to our center's events.